Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
I'm reporting to you live from Six Colors, Arizona outpost in the desert. I'm drying up.
Oh, Jason, you're not at home. I assume that means that something amazing is
Oh yeah, this is the something. What's going on? Why is he not at home? Why are they recording on Thursday?
Why has he left his
Tell
house?
Me where the bomb is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm just down here in the desert visiting my mom. That's all. Nothing that exciting.
I'm in my normal place.
Good for you.
All the windows are open.
What does that mean?
The weather's nice.
All the windows are open. It must be nice. It must be nice to be in a place where you can open windows. You can't do that here. You just die.
Yeah. No,
of the heat.
That's not. Yeah. Well, we haven't gotten to the point. It has been up to 90 in the last couple of days, which is unseasonable for May, but not unusual. And now it's calmed back down to like the 80s.
All the weather talk that I'm not allowed to do by mic on Upgrade anymore. Just stick it in here. So it's a Thursday. I've got some travel related stuff tomorrow, so we're doing it today. Not a lot of big news going on this week. I suppose from a certain point of view, the big news is that somebody noticed that Phil Schiller sent the first Six Colors report card to a bunch of higher up executive type people at Apple in the context of sort of criticizing the App Store and the like. I can't remember if that was right before Schiller took over the App Store or after. I think it was before.
It might have been an argument in the ammunition there for him doing that. It seems like a lot of the emails they got on Earth there felt like Phil, if not jockeying for the position of running the App Store, at least trying to be like, look, somebody needs to do this better than we're doing it.
It looks like he was critical of the App Store, and either he was jockeying to have that position or he complained long enough that Tim Cook was like, well, you take care of it then. But either way, yeah, what's funny about the $6 report card is the individual categories that you see are in some ways a snapshot of what the big issues seem to be in 2015, basically, or 2014, mm-hmm. 2015, because that's when the survey started. And I've tried to keep the categories consistent, but like one of the big reasons that developer relations is on there is because I'm not sure whether I would put it on there today, but I might because of the Epic thing and all that. But there was a period in there after Schiller came back or was put in charge of the App Store that it got a lot better. And but at that particular moment, it was not doing great. And that's one of the reasons the whole, like, let's take the temperature of what developers, you know, how developers feel about Apple. It was in the survey to begin with, but it was a surprise to me that it was one of the emails that got discovered as part of the trial.
And that made me think, Jason, if you start reading that and you realize that they did this that year, do you think they keep reading it? Because part of me feels like it at least crosses their desk every year when it comes out, because I think just a virtue of the fact that you've been doing this for like 6 or 7 years now, it's an expected thing. It's kind of a tradition is not quite the right word, right? But it is a thing that happens every year, and therefore it does, as you intended it to do, provide a certain amount of like data points that you can track over time, which makes me wonder if if you were reading this back in 2015 when it came about and you thought it was notable then, you probably are still going to be like keeping an eye out for it, or at least, like I said, somebody is sending it to you and it's crossing your desk at some point. So I would absolutely believe that they still read it now, perhaps with differing levels of enthusiasm or attention, but I find it hard to believe it doesn't at least make it to their attention.
Yeah, I honestly don't know. Yeah. It's one of those things, like, if you ask me, like, do you know that people read it? I don't. but it seems like at least that Phil did in the early days. So great. Thanks to Phil for reading. Hi, Phil. I have exchanged email with Phil. I think I've told this story before, but I have exchanged email with him before where I made some comment about how there is this really dumb rumor about him that I was like, this is not true. I don't know. I know enough that this is ridiculous. And he emailed me and he says, thank you. Yes, it is completely ridiculous. I was like, all right, okay. It was about cars because, you know, Phil cares about cars a lot. Yeah. But
I ran into him once. That's my story. Is I was coming back from WWDC and I arrived at the gate in Boston.
Right.
And it was back in the day where Virgin would fly when Virgin was still an airline.
Right.
And they had their own little gate space.
Yeah. Yeah, two
and
gates.
I walked out. And it was really weird. And I walked out because, like, I think I went to the bathroom there and came out and saw him sitting there. And I was like, wait, I just came from WWDC. Why is he here? And it would have been one of those years where he wasn't on stage and people were like, oh, there's no Phil on stage or something. And so I was like, no, I might as well go talk to him. So, like, I went and, you know, said hi and introduced myself for, like, you know, talked to him for 2 or 3 minutes or something. I believe he went to high school in the same town I did, though not to the same high school. And he's a Boston area guy. He went to BC, I believe. And I think he's a trustee there, which is why he was in town.
Right.
But it was still an interesting random little encounter where it's like, oh, I know you. This is a weird context in which to see you, but sure.
Here at the Virgin America, little tiny one gate or two gates, one security.
It's funny because that is one of the few places I feel like I have occasionally had celebrity sightings. Because, like, you know, celebrities, unless you get to a certain level of famous, you gotta take a plane like everyone else, right? Like, when my wife and I were on our honeymoon, exactly, you got to get to that level. When my wife and I were our honeymoon in and we're leaving Scotland to fly to Italy. My wife is like a, you know, she's flown a lot over the years, so she has access to a lot of like the fancy lounges and stuff. And so we were sitting in a lounge and we were super delayed. And I looked over at one point and it being Scotland, I was like, you know, that guy over there really looks like Alan Cumming. And it was Alan Cumming. Yeah. And I went and said hi to him too, because I figured, why not?
Sure. He was just enjoying his lounge where they keep the riffraff out, but they didn't keep you out.
No, not me. Haha. Take that, Alan Cumming.
Take that. I have been using, so here I brought, I've written a lot about like traveling with just an iPad, but with the M1 MacBook Air and kind of not wanting to deal with all the limitations of iPad recording for podcasts and stuff, I just brought the, like I'm doing a D&D session tonight, right? And it's like, I can't do that on the iPads. It's just not gonna happen. So I brought the MacBook Air M1 MacBook Air, which is great. And I have my iPad as well. And I've been working the last couple of days using Sidecar, which, you know, I've used theoretically sort of to test it for reviews and stuff. But it's been a while. The last time I had a setup like this where I felt like I wanted a second screen, it was using, you know, some third-party app that did this. And having it integrated into the system is really quite delightful. And having two 13-inch Retina displays next to each other is not a bad substitute for my 27-inch iMac Pro display. So that's actually been a fun use of Sidecar, and I'm impressed at that the latency is pretty low and the quality is very good and all of those things. So I got to put a feature of Mojave into practice. Anyway, that's worked pretty well.
I occasionally use that in very random use cases with just my old iPad, but it's certainly not as nice as those two screens. And having not had an occasion to travel and take my computer anywhere recently, it's not been something I've needed to do. But I think it's a feature that most people, you know, a lot of people won't need just sitting at their desk every day. But if you are somebody who travels frequently and you're used to having two monitors, I can absolutely see the value of it. So
yeah, I mean,
it's nice when you find those things that like are, this has been around for a while and you kind of forget about it because you don't need it in like your main context. And then you switch context and you're like, gosh, if only there were some way to, wait a second, there is this thing.
Well, I mean, in truth, I have these two devices here and I had that moment where I thought, because I have my iPad out next to the Mac, and I thought, well, wait a second, I'm actually doing a couple of things here where I could use more screen real estate, and I have the iPad and we can do Sidecar, and it just sort of happened. It was never part of the plan, but I was like, oh, there is a feature that will allow me to use this. And my argument against Sidecar has always been sort of like, yeah, but I could just, if I want to put Twitter up over there or whatever, I'll just use the Twitter app on my iPad. Why would I extend my desktop? But, you know, with the stuff I've been doing for a project that should be out on Six Colors next week, I've had a bunch of documents open and I've got some charts that I'm doing and there's a whole bunch of stuff going on. And it is a good use of the multiple monitors, because I want to have like that second document open, and I want to have the charts accessible, and I'd like to be able to see them simultaneously with the thing I'm working on instead of having to flip back and forth on the one screen. Sure. And it's like, oh yeah, this is actually the perfect use for Sidecar. And you know, Sidecar lets you turn off the like the keyboard equivalents and the touch bar and stuff like that, if you want to just make it a pure second screen, and it does a pretty good job of that. Also, you can switch away from Sidecar as an app on the iPad, which is kind of fun. So like I had to look at something on my iPad, so I sort of flip open and go to the home screen, and I open another app and look at something, and then in the dock is Sidecar, and I tap on that and the screen comes back up. And I think the most important point there, and this is that Apple platform owner magic, is unlike other devices where when you switch away it immediately drops the monitor on the Mac and all your windows move back, when Sidecar is in the background, there's at least a somewhat of a grace period where it's still there, right? And the Mac still sees it as an external monitor, even though it's not in displaying at the moment. And then when you switch back, it comes back up. But at no point does your Mac freak out and say, ah, it's not there anymore, which is a nice touch.
What's interesting about that, and it kind of touches upon something that I think you and I talked about last week, and I think you also talked about with Mike on Upgrade this week, is that, you know, the idea of the external monitor support and apps and multitasking on iPadOS, right? And how, going all the way back to the earliest days of the iPhone, you know, iOS has always been aggressive about the way it treats apps in the background for very good reason, right? Like, you are concerned about battery life on this device that you're carrying around with you that has a very small battery on it and yet is asked to do many, many very demanding things. So we've all run into problems even where apps have kind of run amok in the background and probably drained our battery a lot faster than we're expecting. And so, you know, iOS has this very aggressive background mode where you put an app and you switch away from it. And, you know, if you leave it there for any period of time, it often, you know, has to sort of gracefully exit and suspend what you're doing.
And you don't know what's going on back there. Like, is it still doing things? Is it going to die momentarily? Do I have to switch back? And it never happens on the Mac, right?
Not a problem you ever worry about on the Mac. And I think that is actually one of the things that potentially holds back a lot of this. And it's just because it's even with really, really basic stuff, right? And I think about this on other platforms. Apple TV has the same issue. Like, who among us has not switched to an Apple TV app and like, oh, I gotta go do something in settings or whatever, gone back only to find yourself back at the splash screen, and then you have to tell it which profile you're using again. And it's like, this is annoying. It's not cool, and it's a frustrating experience when all you need to do is like, oh man, I need to grab something from this other app. I got to copy something and paste it into this app. And like, if that were on the Mac, and every time you copied something and switched back to another app, it had to relaunch, you would be like, oh my God, this is so irritating.
A good example is when I edit podcasts. So like this podcast, I will put into Logic and I will trim it and put the little beeps and boops in, and then it'll export. When I'm exporting in Logic, bouncing is what it's called, any project, you know, I started going and then it takes a little while. And so I switch to other apps and I do other stuff and then it's done and then I move on with my workflow. When I edit a podcast in Ferrite on the iPad, which I love to do, it's great. I do The Incomparable there most weeks. When I export it, like, I either put the iPad down and go do something else, and it's not because of the speed, it's because of the background thing. Or I do what I consider to be one of the dumbest things possible, which is I bring up like Twitter or Slack or something in split view or in slide over and leave Ferrite there exporting. And it's like, you know, because I don't want, and I know that probably the developer of Ferrite would be like, oh, well, you know, it's got 2 minutes, it'll be fine. But like, I don't know that. And too often I've been bitten where you send it off in the background and then you come back and it's like, oh, well, I had to stop because I was using too much memory and the system killed me. And so I end up in this situation where I have to, the system killed me. It was a great 80s album,
Or like super cyberpunk, I feel like, very Tron or something.
Yeah, sure. So that's right. I fight for the users, but the system killed me. So I do the stupid like split view thing just so that I can keep that job going. And that was one of my moments of realization when I was talking to Mike, and this was the member piece. We talked about it last week and it was the member piece last week, right after I wrote it, right after we talked, which is, you know, I don't do that on the Mac because there are windows and they can be in layers, and I have trust that that app is not gonna die. And maybe just the mere fact that there's that much RAM in the M1 iPad Pro means that it won't kill those apps like it used to. But like, it's still out of sight means it may be out of mind, and I don't like that. And I feel like iPadOS needs to be better at that stuff.
Right. And it also goes to a problem like you and I have complained in the past at length, as many of our other podcaster friends have.
That's what about we do. We complain at length. That's our job.
Complain at length.
Tell the IRS. That's our job.
Official complainer. About the lack of a good podcasting workflow for recording on an iPad, right?
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't really work well. And part of that is probably because you can't run an app in the background and expect it to keep recording all of your audio. Like, again, even if the system theoretically allows that, the sort of the trust, the innate feeling of like, I can put this app away and it will keep doing what it's supposed to be doing while I'm on this other app, does not fill you with like, ooh, this feels like a very reliable bulletproof workflow. Like, it feels like, oh no, I am balancing on a tightrope over a pit of sharks. Why are there sharks there? I don't know, but they're there and they're hungry. So I feel like that's something that, you know, it is a frustration for people looking to do workflows that do require multitasking. And it's not, again, we're not saying like, oh yes, we need the super advanced multitasking of, you know, all these systems have to offer. We're just like, I want to do something. I need an app to finish doing something in the background while I'm doing something else. That's it.
Much as a clever hack as I guess it is that there's split view and slide over, the fact is that it's just papering over the fact that iOS is still essentially one app per kind of a concept, and the Mac is not. And I'm not going to defend. See, I wish I was going to dig this out at some point. Mike and I had a discussion a few years ago on Upgrade about, you know, like tiling or like how a stack of windows might not be the best solution. I think he maybe has changed his mind a little bit, but I'm willing to say that the metaphor that we use on the Mac today is maybe not a 21st century metaphor, and maybe there's another take on it. And I like the idea that Apple, its designers and developers are like working on like with the new take on this. We want to do this same thing that the Mac did, but we want to do it in a new way. Fair enough. I'm open to that possibility. But the fact that I've got these two devices that are M1 devices, the MacBook Air 13-inch M1 devices, right? The MacBook Air and the iPad Pro. And one of them is I can do all sorts of stuff in the background and it's all great. And the other one, I'm terrified of putting anything in the background. It's just like you can't do that. You need to rethink what, you know, app behavior is. And if you tie it into the big external display thing, then you realize, oh well, like there has to be an answer for big external displays, because you can't just put an app on a 27 or a 30-inch display. It like a single iPhone app, essentially. It's just not going to happen. So, right. You know, something's got to give there, and I'm hoping that it'll happen at WWDC. And I would love to see a new take on kind of layering and windowing and tiling and something like that from Apple that gives me that, because, you know, I mean, obviously recording podcasts on the iPad, there are a whole bunch of other dominoes that would need to fall there in terms of the audio subsystem and all of that. But more broadly, like, yeah, if I can keep an app open and then run another app, and I can keep my eye on that app and I have confidence that it's still running and doing what it needs to do. I know why that wasn't the case on the early iPhones and all that. But like as a pro device, especially, like I can't not trust my apps to keep running. I can't. Yeah. And my Mac does it fine. And why doesn't my iPad do it?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's the big question that going into WWDC, we're all kind of wondering, like, what is this going to look like, right? What does this mean at this point? And there isn't really a good idea of what that, what the implications for that might be. And Apple has, I think we've said this too before, but like Apple made this bed for themselves by putting the M1 in the iPad Pro. They did that, right? One likes to think that they did that with full knowledge and understanding of exactly the conclusions that would be drawn. That might be optimistic, I don't know, but they're not dummies. They know that like people are going to stack these things up against each other. So I would think that means they're prepared for it. But I guess we'll find out in about a week and a half whether or not that's true. So, but it's an interesting situation, and they make me think more and more about, like, you know, what is the next step for the iPad? Because as we said, like, I think so much of that stuff with the being aggressive about killing stuff in the background is a holdover from when you really needed
extremely low RAM conditions in early iPhones.
RAM and battery, right? Like the fact that you're like expecting someone to be on battery basically 99% of the day. And I don't think either of those things is necessarily true with the iPad anymore, right? Like, in some ways, the forking of iPad OS does free them up to the ability to say, like, okay, maybe this is something we can tweak on the iPad side, at least, where it's like, yeah, people are on battery, but the battery is bigger. It potentially lasts longer. People are more likely to use their iPad plugged in, probably, than their iPhone, even.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a ton more RAM now.
There's a lot of RAM. You just don't need to worry about it.
Yeah, maybe that's where we're heading, but it you know, they got to make the decision to do that, and I'm all in favor of it. And like you said, I think the answer is the answer of grafting Windows from the Mac, you know, system onto iPad is maybe not the right solution. And I'm willing to entertain, you know, other ideas, but I do think I agree with you that, you know, at the base level, split view and slide over feel very much like a hack. And if you're being charitable, you could say that's the kind of thing you put in there for a few years while you figure out how the heck you're really going to do this,
mm-hmm.
and hope that that gets people through long enough. And it's hit the breaking point. It's hit the point where that no longer suffices.
The external display thing, I think, is the one that really just makes it fall apart. It's already frustrating, but like you literally just, you cannot support regular apps that go to full or half size on an external display. And so if you really want to do that, and it looks like you really want to do that, why'd you put Thunderbolt in this thing? Why are you crowing about it working with the Pro Display XDR? You know, plus you've got pointer support. Like you add it all up and it's like, okay, well, another move needs to be made here. Just, you can't, like, you could get away with it on the 12.9 inch iPad Pro. Although I would argue that looking at my 13-inch MacBook Air, it would benefit from this as an option to have some like iPhone app-sized things floating and some iPad app-sized things floating, and I could take it into full screen if I want to, but I don't have to. Like, great. But external displays, you can't even get away from it. It has to be. So I hope they do something. I feel like they need to address this one way or another, but you know, that's the trick, right? Is that we all think, aha, this is the way to address it. And it turns out for some reason they can't, or they're not ready to yet. Instead, they'll slide something else and say, this sort of addresses it. And it's like, does it? But sometimes they surprise us and in a good way, and sometimes they disappoint us. And that's the danger of getting too excited about wish casting WWDC, because you can't ever get everything you want. And you're just hoping for the best result and that they've made some good. I mean, the truth is, you hope that they made some decisions that match your priorities. And it's not always the case, but you know, there's two things, right? There's, as an observer of Apple, you observe them and you're like trying to think of big picture, but there's also your, as a user of Apple products, I find like that's the counterbalancing thing, which is like, yeah, but I really want this feature. I know nobody else wants it, but I really want it. And it's like, well, I can be both. I can do both. You linked to Joe Rosenstiel's excellent review of the Apple TV. Mm. Joe has opinions about the Apple TV. He shared them all. It's a great review. When we last left you were waiting for an Apple TV remote to be delivered. How'd that go?
It showed up. I've all been right, using good. It. And I mostly like it, with a couple reservations, I think, as I've mentioned, and you and I both talked about this, and I think elsewhere. It's like so close to being the only remote that I could use, but unfortunately, because of the way the power button works, it doesn't work with external infrared controlled devices. I think it basically, I'm guessing that button does not even send an IR signal. I would guess it's Bluetooth or something, and it wakes up sort of the Apple TV and then uses HDMI CDC to wake up anything connected to it, which is great, unless you have a receiver like me that is so old it's relying on RCA plugs.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a bummer. I wish there were, and you know, finger, one could think maybe they could fix that in software. Is it high on their priority list? I sincerely doubt it, but it would be nice. I spent a while trying to figure out if there was some sort of clever workaround I could do, and the answer was, I don't think so. I think I still need my Harmony or something, you know, even using the Harmony as an intermediary from HomeKit or something like that, to at least send an IR signal to turn on the receiver. But I haven't been able to figure out a way to be like, oh man, I wish I could have shortcuts on the Apple TV to tell it to run something when it wakes up or something like that. That would actually probably help. But I really enjoy the clickiness of that new remote. I think that the button layout is much better. I loved, as I mentioned, my favorite bit from Joe Steele's review is he mentions the Siri button on the side. And why did they put the Siri button aside? And he cites, I think, an interview with one of the Apple executives. He's like, well, you know, we really want to mimic where the Siri button is on your phone. And Joe's like, but you don't hold a remote like you hold a phone. And I was like, Joe is 100% right about this. You do not hold a remote like you hold a phone. And it's weird to have it on the side. And moreover, if you're so concerned about that, why are your volume buttons on top of the remote and not on the side where they are on the iPhone? And the answer is, because that would be really stupid, mm-hmm. because that is not how anybody uses a remote. So yeah, it's not entirely free of some of Apple's little idiosyncrasies when it comes to designing these things, but it is definitely better than its precursor. And I think that the addition of sort of that click wheelie style, like, you know, touch surface slash click directional pad is much, much better than the touchpad that existed before. I think that's a huge improvement.
It's just the fact that so many Apple TV apps are going to need to be revised because they have made a bunch of assumptions based on the old Apple remote and they don't work right, which is frustrating. My big report from the Apple TV, I'm not sure if I mentioned this last time, is Major League Baseball updated their MLB app, which I use all the time because I'm an MLB at Bat subscriber. I just watch kind of random baseball games. It's nice. Not my local team, but you know, it's fine. It's like I'll watch my local team when my local team is playing, but otherwise it's like, oh, the Red Sox are playing the Braves. Yesterday I was watching that game. There was a rain delay. I guess you got some rain.
Yes, yes, there was.
Go figure. So they used to have this really cool 2-up display. Now, on the web, they've got a 4-up. It's pretty amazing. You have four games going at once. But the app used to have this 2-up where you basically hit the menu button after you're playing one game and it zooms back and you can kind of swipe over and add another game, and then they play side by side, and you can click to zoom in on one of them and press menu, and it would go back to the 2-up, and you can swipe over, and the sound goes to the other one, and you can click to go into that one. It was clever, but you know, Apple introduced the picture-in-picture feature into tvOS, and slowly developers have been, you know, kind of coming to grips with the fact that that's the official authorized way to do picture in picture. So the MLB app got updated. I think it's a lot more boring than it was before. It also looks a lot more like their Roku app and their Amazon Fire TV app, which is, you know, it's less interesting, but it supports picture in picture. So I can still do two games, although now it's a small one and a big one, right? It's a picture in picture instead of side by side. But you know, it's got the interface to flip those two around and stuff. And you know, the winning thing here is that it supports other apps with picture-in-picture. So you can now, and I did this the other day. I had a basketball game from ESPN Plus and a baseball game from MLB in picture-in-picture on my Apple TV. And I was like, okay, all right. Like, this is good. Because that's what you really want, ultimately, is you want all of these apps. If there are scenarios where you have two things you want, a soccer match that's on this thing and a baseball game that's on this thing, whatever it is, to be able to do sort of two and swap back and forth between them, you can do that if the apps support it. But the apps are gradually supporting it, just like the scroll wheel isn't really properly supported in a bunch of places, and it's, you know, it's frustrating, and I'm willing to give it a little time because this thing just came out, but I did notice that in a bunch of my apps the behavior is not great. And they're just gonna have to, they were making assumptions, right? Because everybody's building their own little custom player instead of using the Apple standard player, and they're like, well, we can fake it. And then something like this happens and their fake out doesn't work with the new remote, and you know, they're gonna have to go back to the drawing board. But I don't know, it's loud. That was another thing that I noticed about the remote, is that it's super loud when you click on it. Noticeably it loud. clicky.
I will say it wasn't a big departure for me, if only because having been a user of the Harmony remote for so many years, I was using a D-pad to navigate the ecosystem. And it works fine for the most part. Mm-hmm. There are some places that are peculiar, although I chalk them up, as you just said, more to being apps being weird. Like, I cannot figure out for the life of me, the HBO Max app has a button that shows up when you want to skip an intro. I don't know how it works. I cannot figure out how to access it, because every time I hit the button thinking, oh, this will skip like it does in every other app, it pauses. And I think, what the hell?
I just had that happen and it worked. And I was shocked that it actually finally worked. And I don't know whether they changed it or whether it's like the new Apple remote works with it or what. But my theory, which I think I mentioned some podcast this week I mentioned it, but I'll mention it again here, is my theory is because you can turn touch off on the Apple TV remote and make it a much more pure up, down, left, right, I feel like every Apple TV app, part of the recalibration with this new remote is going to need to be that every Apple TV app makes sure that it works right with up, down, left, right, back, at which point it's going to work better with the Harmony remote because it's the exact same set of buttons. And that's good. Like, that's good for people who have the Harmony remote because hopefully those apps will finally have a reason. It's Apple, but still a reason to support more discrete kind of stuff instead of sort of assuming that the Siri remote is there and that you can just swipe down from the top and it'll be fine. And I don't know. Apple TV, the state of Apple TV apps is an interesting thing where, you know, Apple thought it was getting a lot of benefit from being, you know, adapted versions of iOS apps. And I think it does. But the downside is it's also the lowest priority platform in terms of app development as a set-top box, right?
Yeah. And I think in some ways that's because of the fact that they have also priced it expensively and it's hard to compete, right? So, like, why spend your time addressing a small percentage of your audience when you could update your Roku or Chromecast experience and potentially address that too, or Fire TV, etc.
And the MLB app update is telling in a way because the MLB app used to be not quite at the level of the PlayStation or Xbox apps, which are bananas, like really good and really detailed. But the Apple TV app was like a place where they tried to do some interesting things. And this last update is literally, it's just going to look like it does on Roku. We're not going to try special things on the Apple TV anymore. We're going to put our lowest common denominator interface on it, and we're done. And that is a problem because, you know, their app on the iPad and the iPhone is better, but it seems like they're kind of shearing away from the idea that we can just use our iPhone or our iPad app and then modify it for Apple TV. And they've changed their philosophy to be sort of like, we'll just do, you know, the basics.
There's a handful of things that frustrate me about tvOS and the Apple TV, and I think Joe hits upon a lot of the stuff with the Apple TV in particular, and specifically how Apple positions and markets it, which I think remains a challenge. But I think even tvOS, which has improved and there's a lot of stuff I like about it, suffers from, it's not just the buy-in on that aspect of like the development, but it's also the buy-in on like Apple has, you know, tried to push certain features to the forefront, like their ability to have their sort of watch now section, right, and stuff that ties in with that. But the problem is that Netflix is like literally never going to do that. And so, you know, it hampers sort of the effectiveness of overall when Apple's like, we've got this one place that you can go to look at all the shows that you're watching and see where the next episode is, except for Netflix, don't worry about it. And everyone's like, well, but I use Netflix a lot. What am I supposed to do? And the answer is, well, you still got to go to the Netflix app. And even there, I found that the implementation of that section annoying because I frequently have things where like, I go back and rewatch episodes, especially for things I'm doing podcasts about, and it never remembers. Like, it's like, oh, you reached the credits. You must not be done with this. I'm like, no.
Yep.
I'm done with it. Deal with that.
Yep.
And I have one thing where, like, I watched, there's a couple shows I watch on the Paramount Plus app. And for a while, its tie-in stuff was really bad. It would keep showing me, like, the first episode of a season. Or it was, like, weirdly numbered or something. And it looked like today when I went in to watch an episode, I was like, oh, it's actually showing me the correct episode. Maybe they fixed that. So maybe they finally got around to addressing it. But it is definitely a thing where it's like, it showcases when apps don't do the work or have decided that they only kind of want to cursorily support something.
I get a favorite team thing, which is like, hey, your favorite team is on. It's like, yeah, but that's only if you're out of market, which I'm not. An MLB app does that too, where my favorite team is the Giants. There are benefits to having it set as my favorite team in like the iPad app and the iPhone app, where it gives me access to their score and their audio and all of that right away. But on the video app, on the TV, they devote this huge amount of space to your favorite team with a watch now, except it's always blacked out. Unless you're in a different market.
I don't even,
it's like, what are you doing?
Yeah, I don't even watch like Red Sox games on my Apple TV, and yet because I have it marked in the MLB app from years past,
and that's,
it still
that's
always shows up there when they're playing.
That's their fault because of the way they've implemented it and how it's tied into the TV app. But, you know, I get stuff like that too, where it's like, this is really helpful, but it's actually not helpful at all. I don't know. It's a work in progress. I still use it.
It's not a way people, yeah.
Same. Apple TV, like here at my mom's, there's a Roku and, you know, it's fine. It's not as good as the Apple TV, but it's fine. And it was super cheap. But like, I like the Apple TV fine, but I also, it just should be way better. That's the bottom line, especially given how expensive it is and that it's from Apple and it's in the ecosystem. It needs to be better. And part of the challenge is they are relying on third-party developers who don't have a lot of motivation to make it better.
I can't remember where I wrote this, whether it was on Macworld or at Six Colors, but I definitely wrote at some point that like the Apple TV is the weirdest app in some ways because it's the one Apple product I can think of that most Apple aficionados will tell you it's too expensive, it's not good enough, and you shouldn't buy it. And yet they then buy it. Yeah. like it is a weird conflicting feeling because I'm right with you there. And I know several people who are like, yeah, it's all shortcomings, problems. Like, yeah, but I went out and bought a new one. It's like, why? Like John Moltz buying his highest capacity Apple TV. I'm like, John, please, you got to stop. You got to stop buying the highest capacity one. You're throwing money away.
He wants to load a lot of games.
Wants to load all the games.
All the games.
That's right. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, tvOS very rarely... The amount of attention it gets at WWDC is, like, it's extremely variable. Some years, they're like, we got a bunch of stuff. And some years, it's like, there's, like, two things. And it's like, you don't know. It's a crapshoot.
Yeah. All right, well, we're less than 2 weeks away from the developer conference. All our questions will be answered, or not. As the case may be.
New questions will be raised.
Always. All right. Well, we'll check in again next week, right in the right before we are in the teeth of it. Do a little prep. Do a little pep talk. Do a little truck heist. We'll get ready for WWDC. Things that you see on The Flash and Arrow and other shows in the CW.
That's right.
Yeah. You know what I was saying.
Pep talks.
Yep. Truck heists. That's what they got, right? Like Ren Fasterberry.
That's it.
Yep. I stopped watching that show like 5 years ago. It's still on.
Yep. I still watch it and I don't know why.
Yeah. That's fair enough. Well, if Barry just runs faster, give him a pep talk and he'll run faster and then he'll it's solved. Faster. Anyway, that's my criticism of The Flash, which I dearly loved and then I dearly did not love anymore. Mm-hmm. All right. Until next week, thanks for being a subscriber to Six Colors. We appreciate you. We hope you appreciate us. Sorry that this is a Thursday. What could you do? You know, it's just the way it is. And we'll see you next Friday. Until then, bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.